Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, Sean Young. Before we get started on this new miniseries on the podcast, I want to give a giant shout out to all of our listeners and subscribers who were in Dallas this past weekend for the JFK assassination conferences. It was awesome meeting so many of you, and I really enjoyed the group tours we did and the great discussions we had over those 3 days. I know I didn't get to meet all of you, but while I was in Dealey Plaza handing out information cards about this podcast, I had so many tell me that they were already listening and really appreciated the work I'd done on this subject. For the others that I did get a chance to meet and spend time with, I promise you all a shout-out, so here you go. Again, it was great meeting you all, and I can't thank you enough for the support you have shown this podcast and me with the release of my book, The End of Innocence. So shout-out to Candace from New Jersey, Stephanie from Utah, Paul from the UK, Mark from Australia, Jim from Minnesota, Reed and Kathy from Oklahoma, Don from Washington, Stacy and Mickey from Tennessee, Jackson from Missouri, Sean, Chase, Jason, and Michelle, all from Dallas, and a special shout out to the two brothers that went on several adventures with me last weekend, Dan Meeker from California and his brother Jeff Meeker from Indiana. Look forward to staying in touch with you all until we meet again next November in Dallas. Now on to this week's episode that I'm very excited about.
Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I've received hundreds of emails since I started this podcast, asking me what were some of the things that happened leading up to or on the day of the assassination or even afterwards that leads me to believe there was a conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy. What are some of the absolutes that I stand by when it comes to the Kennedy assassination that I feel proves a conspiracy, or at least things are not what they seem to be or what we were told they were? Today I start a new miniseries that I'm calling The JFK Assassination Hills to Die On. A hill to die on means a cause, belief, or position that someone is so strongly committed to that they are willing to fight for it, even to the very end, even if it means facing significant consequences or defeat. Essentially, it's an issue someone considers so important they are prepared to stand their ground no matter what. So over the next several episodes, I will be covering what I feel like are some of the hills to die on when it comes to the JFK assassination. Many people believe only the release of thousands of pages of evidence and other materials still held by the American intelligence agencies will be necessary to know the truth of the Kennedy assassination. I disagree with that notion. I think there is enough evidence that has been uncovered through the years of research to know what our history books tells us about the assassination is not accurate. We can examine what we already know is proven to be accurate leading up to or on the day of the assassination and look at some of these hills to die on. One hill to die on when it comes to the assassination is the fact that there was some foreknowledge of the assassination from several sources. There have been several instances, some more well-known than others, of people seemingly having foreknowledge of President Kennedy's assassination, meaning they knew he would be killed before it happened. The key questions to consider are whether the alleged foreknowledge was specific and whether the claims about the person having that information is credible. One recently declassified document hints at such foreknowledge. It was a letter from CIA Counterintelligence Chief James Angleton to the FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. The memo mentions an anonymous caller to a Cambridge, England newspaper who said, quote, "Call the American Embassy in London for some big news," end quote. The caller then hung up. Notably, this call was made 25 minutes before President Kennedy was shot in Dallas. While it wasn't specifically about President Kennedy, the timing is close enough to suggest a connection. Also, when it comes to foreknowledge of the assassination, we have the infamous tape recording of Joseph Miltier, a known racist and leader of the States Rights Party. On November 9, 1963, Miltier was secretly recorded by Miami police informant Willie Somerset, discussing how President Kennedy's assassination was, quote, "in the works," end quote. Miltier provided specific details. Here's an excerpt from that tape.
"I don't know if Kennedy's coming here. They're
If you couldn't understand that, Somerset asked the best way to get him, and Mateer responded, quote, from an office building with a high-powered rifle, end quote. Much of the tape is very difficult to understand, so it's easier to read the highlights in the transcript. Somerset says, I don't know how them Secret Service agents cover all of them office buildings everywhere he is going. Do you know whether they do that or not? Mateer then says, well, if they have any suspicion, they do that. Of course, without suspicion, chances are they wouldn't. Mateer would later say, hell, they'll pick up somebody within hours after, if anything like that would happen, just to throw the public off, end quote. According to the Secret Service, Mateer wasn't just talk. He had ties to the people who blew up a black church in Birmingham, Alabama in September 1963, killing four young girls. The Miami Secret Service sent a copy of the Mateer tape to Robert Buock, the head of the Protective Research Section of the Secret Service. Buock asked the Miami field office to investigate further. This resulted in reports being sent to five Secret Service field offices. However, the report was never sent to the Dallas office, meaning the threats in the Mateer tape never reached the people planning the Dallas motorcade. Late in the evening of Tuesday, November 19, 1963, just days before President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, a woman named Rose Sheremy got into an argument with two men at the Silver Slipper Lounge, a roadside bar in Eunice, Louisiana. After the men left her at the bar, Sheremy began hitchhiking down the highway, but was struck by a car not far from the Silver Slipper. The driver who hit her rushed her to the hospital, where it was determined that she had no major injuries. However, the hospital staff called Lieutenant Francis Frugier of the Louisiana State Police because Sheremy appeared to be on drugs. Frugier took Sheremy to jail, but her erratic behavior, including stripping off her clothes in her cell, prompted him to transfer her to East Louisiana State Hospital, the same mental institution in Jackson where Lee Harvey Oswald had reportedly applied for a job. After being sedated by a doctor, Frugier was able to speak with Sheremy, who was experiencing heroin withdrawals. During the two-hour trip from Eunice to Jackson, which occurred in the early morning hours of Thursday, November 21, 1963, Sheremy told Frugier, quote, we're going to kill President Kennedy in a few days, end quote. She also mentioned traveling with two men, but Frugier did not take her seriously due to her sedated and erotic state. Here is Rose Sheremy's story, told by respected JFK assassination researcher and author James D. Eugenio.
Through the credit sequence of Oliver Stone's JFK, we get, in segments, the story of a woman who's thrown out of a car, abandoned, ends up in a hospital, and warns the people in attendance that President Kennedy is about to be killed in Dallas. She says that these are serious men and somebody has to do something. What not very many viewers realize is that this story was absolutely true and was investigated by Jim Garrison, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and now the Review Board has released more documents on this remarkable story of this woman who 3 days in advance predicted that President Kennedy would be killed in Dallas. On November the 20th, 1963, Louise Guillory, a hospital director at Moosa General Hospital, called State Trooper Francis Frugier, who worked in narcotics detail. She told him that they had a patient at the hospital who was under the influence. Frugier went over and found a woman named Rose Sheremy in the waiting room outside the emergency room. Moosa was a private hospital, so Frugier had to arrange to have her transferred and also to receive a sedative. On the way to the state hospital at Jackson, Louisiana, Rose Sheremy began to relate her remarkable story. She was en route from Florida to Dallas as part of a drug deal. Rose Sheremy was to function as a courier of funds for heroin, which was to be dropped off to her by a seaman coming into the port of Galveston. From there, the three were to proceed to Mexico. At a seedy bar en route called the Silver Slipper Lounge, an argument ensued, and Rose was roughly abandoned by her friends, who threw her out. Then while hitching a ride, she was hit by a car driven by a man named Frank Odom. Odom had delivered her to Moosa Hospital, where she was picked up by Frugier. While on the way to Jackson, Rose told Frugier that in Dallas, the men had planned to kill Kennedy. According to several witnesses at the hospital, on November the 22nd, Rose again predicted the assassination before it happened. She also told a doctor there that she knew that both Ruby and Oswald had known each other, and she had seen them together at Ruby's club. Puget later also confirmed that she had worked for Jack Ruby. Another employee at the hospital, an intern named Wayne Owen, told his local newspaper in Wisconsin that he and other interns were told of the plot in advance of the assassination. He said that they even heard that one of the men involved was Jack Rubenstein, which was Jack Ruby's real name. Rose also told of that association with Ruby to Dr. Victor Weiss at Jackson Hospital. After the assassination, Puget told the House Select Committee that he demanded to see Rose Sheremy again to interview her. She told him that her two companions actually seemed to be part of the conspiracy rather than just aware of it. Puget then had her story about the drug deal checked out by both local and federal authorities. Puget then had his superior, Colonel Morgan, call up Captain Wilfritz of the Dallas Police to offer Rose as a witness to his investigation. Morgan told Puget after the call that Fritz was not interested. So, a potentially explosive witness was now turned away in 1963. In 1967, Jim Garrison received several leads about Rose Sheremy from people related to the Jackson Hospital, which is about 3 hours north of New Orleans. This included a friend of Dr. Victor Weiss, a man named A.H. Magruder. Garrison tracked down Puget, deputized him, and then asked him to find Sheremy. Puget found out that she had died in a car accident in 1965. Puget told the House Select Committee in the next decade that he then found the Silver Slipper Lounge, where Rose had become separated from her two friends in 1963. He found the bartender in attendance the night Rose had walked in. The man's name was Mac Manuel. Puget displayed to Manuel several photos of suspects from the Garrison investigation. Manuel picked out the two men he had seen with Rose Sheremy that night. This is significant because, as we now know, both Cubans were at Guy Bannister's office in New Orleans, and they both knew David Ferry and Clay Shaw. So now, according to this verified Sheremy story, we have a connection between New Orleans and Texas just days prior to the murder of President Kennedy.
Richard K. Snegale might have been one of the most crucial witnesses in the backstory of the JFK assassination, or he might have been an unconventional individual with some unexplainable items in his possession. Here's a brief summary of his story, as it shows of his possible foreknowledge of the Kennedy assassination. On September 20, 1963, Richard K. Snegale walked into a bank in El Paso, Texas, fired two shots into the wall near the ceiling, then calmly walked back out to his car and waited to be arrested. Nagel later claimed he was a double agent for both the U.S. and the KGB. He knew Lee Harvey Oswald and was monitoring a JFK assassination plot involving Cuban exiles. He asserted that he had been ordered to kill Oswald to prevent the plot and sent a registered letter to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover warning of the plot. When arrested, Nagel had names of active intelligence assets in his notebook. On April 7, 1964, the CIA's Director of Security wrote to the FBI listing these names and requesting, quote, "It would be appreciated if your bureau would advise this agency of any information brought to your attention concerning how the above names came in possession of Richard K. Snegale," end quote. When the trunk of his car was examined at his arrest, at his suggestion, by the way, authorities found a number of most interesting items. Unfortunately, the majority of these were never formally entered into the record, and most were not returned to Nagel after his conviction for bank robbery was eventually overturned. The items that are available are amazingly similar to those items that were found in the possession of Lee Harvey Oswald after his arrest. They include one Minolta spy camera and developing kit. Oswald had the same camera in his possession. Fair Play for Cuba leaflets. Oswald had these in his possession also. The P.O. Box for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans, Louisiana, the committee which had only one member, Lee Harvey Oswald. Cuban and communist literature, including the case against Cuba by Corliss Lamnet, one of these documents also being used in New Orleans by Lee Harvey Oswald. He had a notebook containing the unlisted telephone number of the Cuban embassy, the same number as found in Oswald's notebook. The notebook also contained names of individuals who would much later be identified as CIA personnel from its Los Angeles office. The names were submitted by the FBI to the CIA in October of 1963 and eventually verified by the CIA as being names of actual employees. In addition, the trial files of Richard Nagel also contained an identification card, the card being a military ID with Nagel's photo and the name and signature of Lee Harvey Oswald. Nagel also had a near duplicate of Oswald's Uniform Service Identification and Privileges card, but the card read Alex J. Heidel and featured Oswald's photo. This document is not available in the Warren Commission volumes, but is mentioned in author Dick Russell's book about Richard Case Nagel entitled The Man Who Knew Too Much. Nagel died from heart disease on November 1, 1995 in Los Angeles, California. His death occurred one day after the Assassinations Record Review Board had sent him a letter for information. He was 65 years old at the time of his death and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. According to Dick Russell, Nagel told his niece about a purple trunk containing key evidence about the JFK assassination. After Nagel's death, his son Robert found the address of a storage unit in Tucson, Arizona, and traveled there to retrieve the contents. Upon arrival, Robert discovered the purple trunk was missing. When Robert returned home to California, his house had been broken into and ransacked. Robert told researcher Richard Booth via email in late 1997 or early 1998 that immediately after his father died, a man and a woman claiming to be from the State Department visited his house and asked to look in his father's study. The trunk has never been seen again. New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison would call Richard Case Nagel the most important witness in the Kennedy assassination.
Enter Richard Case Nagel. 2 months prior to the assassination, Nagel, a decorated veteran of the Korean War and U.S. intelligence operative for the CIA, had discovered that there was a conspiracy to assassinate JFK and that Lee Harvey Oswald was to be the patsy. Nagel, then convinced it was in his own best interest to do so, walked into a Texas bank, demanded a mere $100, then fired 2 rounds into the ceiling before walking outside and waiting for the police to arrive. The arresting officers don't know what to make of Nagel. He isn't saying much to them, and they don't know who he is or that what he knows makes him fear for his own life. In the summer of 1962, in the lead-up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, Richard Nagel was tasked with feeding false information to the Soviets. They, in turn, are convinced Nagel had double-crossed the Americans and entrust him not only with the duty of keeping an eye on a group of anti-Castro Cubans they believed were plotting to kill the American president, but also was watching another individual, one that, at this time, was not involved or suspected to be involved with any plot against Kennedy. That individual was a young American who had defected, supposedly, to the Soviet Union, a man by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. Nagel claims that in his investigation of the plot against the president, he discovered the identities of those involved in the conspiracy, and that they, not knowing his true motives, proposed that he participate in the act. At this time, the Russians ordered Nagel to foil the conspiracy by any means necessary, even if it means killing the patsy Oswald. Nagel instead, in an attempt to protect himself both from those involved in the conspiracy and from the Russians for not following orders, decides to purposely get himself arrested for robbing a bank in El Paso, Texas, but not before sending a warning to both J. Edgar Hoover as well as his own superiors at the CIA. While locked up, Nagel tells visiting CIA officials that he wanted to be in custody when the assassination took place in Dallas. This is September 20th, 1963, just 2 months before the assassination actually happens. Later, after JFK is assassinated and Nagel is put on trial for bank robbery, a peculiar thing happens. Before the jury is selected, a new judge is brought in, bam, overnight. The new judge, Homer Thornberry, a very close confidant and friend of new president Lyndon Johnson. Thornberry, himself in Texas on the day that JFK was murdered, immediately puts a lid on anything regarding the assassination that Nagel tries to bring up in the trial to put on public record. Ultimately, Thornberry sentences Nagel to 10 years in prison, even though it was obvious that he had not really attempted to rob the bank. Decades later, the Assassination Records Review Board sends Nagel a subpoena to get his story officially recorded. However, he is found dead literally a day after the letter arrives. Despite having no history of cardiac issues, he passed away from a heart attack. The story doesn't end quite there, though. After Nigel's passing, his San Diego apartment is sealed off, and soon after, members of the Assassinations Record Review Board, along with Nigel's son, are allowed in. Inside, they find evidence of a series of footlockers in Tucson, Arizona, one of them being the purple trunk, the one that contained all the information on the assassination that they were looking for. Nigel's son leaves for Tucson, and while he's gone, his apartment is broken into and ransacked. Then, when he arrives in Arizona, he finds all the trunks there, and accounted for, all except one, the purple trunk. Taken on its own, the obscure, little-known story of Richard Case Nigel is more than a little troubling. It points strongly to the notion that there exists, and perhaps still does exist, a strong contingency of forces, a group of individuals within our own government that has a vested interest in keeping secret vital information to the assassination of a modern president. Whether this interest is one of self-preservation in the form of covering up incompetency of an agency, or that of saving their own necks, we'll never know, because there are those out there that yet think you don't deserve to know.
If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.